Ian Shadar were colleagues, in fact.
Connected with the Ginsburg?
Probably, yes, yeah. Yes. They're both scholars, Ginsburg scholars, quite right. It's exactly what I didn't know anything about that.
At the time.
The Rav Rebbe was a very severe teacher. And I was not a very good pupil. I didn't like him much. But he used to fill my head with heretical things, such as that Esther was really Astarte, that Mordechai was a Babylonian god, Marduk. And similar.
It's very typical to this school of Shazar and others in Moscow.
Moskvili.
Bikoret HaMikra. Soloveitchik, Shazar. He was in this milieu.
Bikoret HaMikra.
Yes.
Soloveitchik is the same.
Yes. He wrote a book in Shazar on Bikoret HaMikra.
The who first. The real Soloveitchik.
No. It's no. Another Soloveitchik who was a minister.
Oh, in Lithuania.
In Lithuania.
Absolutely.
Yes.
And so, of course. Yes. Minister of Jewish Affairs.
Exactly. And then came to Palestine?
Yes, of course. And I think, what's his name? Polish, head of the Polish does it much the same, I suspect. What's his name? What are the chief Zionists?
Yitzhak Greenberg.
Greenberg. Not dissimilar.
Yes, quite right. Yes.
That was the thing. Bearded Jews from those parts of the world. Yeah. Had quite a solid yeshiva education, at some stage. Tried not. I forgot to tell you, before I went to Petersburg, or to Petrograd it was, we spent a year, you see what happened with us. We were in Riga until 1915, where I had my first language was German, because my nurse is German. My nurse is German, through the lead really, the German speaking Latin, called Hanna Polsius, and so I spoke German to 15. I remember being at the age of three, the following facts about myself. I was taken to see my so-called pseudo-grandmother, Israel Berlin's wife, who's called Chayeta.
Chayeta.
This was a kind of Europeanization of Chayeta. And she used to have a song that was all began with the words Chayeta Jolie Coqueta. She was an old lady of 19, two probably by then, some tremendous age, and I was meant to be presented to her, and I was meant to advance into the room and to kiss her hand. So I shocked and refused to do. And so I was removed in disgrace.
That's 1915.
1930.
Ah.
We're back in time.
I see.
1930, I was four. No, 1912, I was three. I just went my first years. The other thing which I remember is Yitzhak Zadeh's marriage.
Yes.
To my aunt. My father says, tremendous
marriage.
Affair. And I was, his father was quite a rich man. Called Landerberg.
He was, I think, the husband of his mother.
What?
He was his stepfather, I believe. His mother married twice.
Yes, his stepfather was called Ginsburg.
I see.
It had nothing to do with the
girlfriend. I see.
He was called Yitzchak Ginsburg.
Yes, sir.
That was the second husband.
Yes.
Of his mother.
Yes.
His mother was sister of, she was the sister of my grandmother. It's doubly related. First of all, he was my father's first cousin, his mother's sister. Secondly, he married his first cousin, my father's sister. So that when I was taken to the wedding, I was put in a little dress of white antler silk, being dressed in 83, and I was led off this tremendous Klezmer going on,
Klezmer.
They were called tremendous Klezmer going on, and I said in German, Ich hasse diese Schreimusik. I hate this Schreimusik.
Schreimusik.
I invented it.
Ah, really?
There's no such word.
Fantastic.
Schreimusik means screaming. Scream music.
Fantastic.
First, but she hasn't taken away. So I did not attend the wedding. That was anecdotes, not my children.
Yes, sir.
But I have not given any Hebrew or anything else for them. But I've taken the synagogue in Dublin. I said to take the synagogue. And then the Germans came rather near Riga in late 14, in Burgundorf. My parents, where my father was afraid of the Germans coming in. Naturally, no anti-German feelings. The feelings were anti-Russian.
Of course.
This was the time when the commander-in-chief Nikolai Nikolaevich, who was the Tsar's uncle, who was the commander-in-chief of Russian armies, suddenly expelled the Jews with 48,000 inches from the country because they were all potential colonies. The Kaiser scattered leaflets over Latvia saying, Meine liebe Juden, Eden Pope, Meine liebe Eden, promising all kinds of Yiddish pamphlets. What my parents were afraid of, my father, was to be cut off from the timber, the trees, the forests, which didn't come to. So we moved in 1915, about spring, early summer maybe, May, April 15, the Germans still outside, to a little village called Andreapol. Andreapol was in what is called Gubernia, government, from the English district of Pskov, which is still called Pskov, in Western Russia, between Riga and Petersburg, not far from Tver, which was called for a time, it's called Kalinin, yes. And that was a company union. There was a village, which in effect belonged to my father's firm, to the millionaire. There were 2,000 peasants in the village. They did the timber cutting and the sawn. They sawed the timber and didn't saw it, they simply axed it.
Yes.
And then bound it into rafts, which were floated
in the river.
From the Dvina to Riga. Lumber. Exactly. Peasant calendar. And sat on it themselves and played like a concertina. That's what the peasants did. In front was a little tunnel-lit railway station with 100,000, not more, in which there lived the clerks, the officials, all the business, and everyone to do with the business, plus 15 shops, plus other Jews knocking around, who were also shopkeepers, or clerks, or agents, or whatever it was. They formed a Jewish community. Then there were Russians, the police, the administration, the station master, not many.
Doctor
Jew.
There was a doctor.
There was one doctor, he was a Jew.
Chemist was a Jew, probably true.
No, I think the chemist shop was Russian.
I see.
The grocer was Russian.
Now, do you remember it?
Of course I remember it.
Or is it a story that...
No. I see it.
You see it?
Visually. This is 1915. I was six.
Yeah.
That's an age return. I remember things. No. I remember very well the house where my grandparents lived. My mother's parents were made to live there. And though they lived, half the place was a shop. It was kept by a man who was called Isaac the Black, because he looked black. And there the peasants came to buy leather and leather goods and various types of things. And he used to bring flowers sometimes, certain amount of bath I went on. And they talked a bit of Russian. There was a typical Jewish shop. The back of the shop lived my grandparents. That's where the Hasidic meals on Shabbat were consumed. That's the only Shabbat they still kept. Then there were other shops, kept by Russians. And one used to go there to buy bread or to buy herring or whatever it was. Ordinary Russian shops. Plus, a colony of Jews of about maybe 80, 100, all connect to the visit, one way or another. And the train stopped up because it was a railway stop organized for that. That also I remember, my governess also came, who had continued to teach me, and there was a German there who was hiding from the Russians. They didn't want to be arrested. And he was hidden in somebody's attic, and he had an affair with my governess. When that was discovered, my governess was removed. But I had been dealing with it, because these Jewish clerks, some were quite well educated. Their daughters and their wives wore large, sort of country dresses. There were plenty of Russian officers before they were sent to the front, who fled to these people. Some Russian girls, some Jewish. They all went to the forest to collect mushrooms and berries to play balalaikas and sing. This is pure Turgenev
culture. Turgenev,
and I went to this whole thing. This really was idyllic period. Sometimes the soldiers would take me in lorries to their sort of evenings where balalaika was played and they drank. And I sat the corner. The smell of rubber, to this day, burnt rubber, reminds me of the tires of these huge sort of lorries which these soldiers traveled by. All that there was very, but to the cheder. To the cheder I was sent. Or the Malamed. And I did the Bible with the other boys. But as I was a rich man's son, so to speak, then I was treated, given special treatment, which if I had known it, if I understood it, I would not have liked it. It was clear to me afterwards that I was treated rather cautiously, because all the other little boys were poor little boys, you see, and I was a sort of squire's son. And the rabbi used to translate the Bible into his sort of semi-German Yiddish themselves. I remember very well the famous joke, which was very good, Kohelet. Do you know the translation of Kohelet into Yiddish? Yes, goes as follows. Divre, Kohelet ben David, you remember, and Shlomo. Divre Kohelet Shlomo, Melech to Udab Yerushalayim. How did it go? Heaven.
Avelavalim
Kohelet. Goes as follows. Divre, Diverta, Kohelet. Kohelet von Gottnicht. Because the names can't be translated. Ben per Ben. Shlomo Gottnicht. Melech per Melech. Yehuda. Yerushalayim in Yerushalayim. Heaven of Lima Kohelet. Famous joke. That I learned, typical Jewish joke, from the other boys in the Heder. But neither I did my lessons. I learned a certain amount. I was taken to synagogue. And I was treated great, with exaggerated respect by all the parents of these children, because I was a sort of special child. The great social center of the station. That's where people used to go to meet the trains. They didn't know anybody. They liked seeing it. Life. Sometimes people got off, people got on, people drank tea, people drank coffee, people went on. The central center was the railway station, particularly the Jews. That's the gossip was, so the wives met. See what I mean? They would say to their husbands, put on your trousers, let's go to the station. That was a unique form of life. And let me tell you, I learned something from this. I'll tell you what I learned. That's something which really, in a sense, given me a lot of knowledge of what Judaism is in that part of the world. In Riga, in Andreapolis, it's called Andreapolis because the squires' names were in the place, but always called Andre. The Russian was
to still Prince Andre.
What? Andrew.
Yes. Andre. Prince Andre. Yes.
They were all called Andre. Andre, son of Andre, son of Andre. There was a generation of Andres. The name is Kushlev, was his actual surname. He lived in the manor house, old, half ruined, drank too much. It was a decayed manor house, how to begin with. We used to sometimes take to see half of these expeditions in the country. He occasionally invited these people to come and have some coffee on the terrace. He was a very broken old Russian squire, good fellow. And I saw what that was like too. So I really was acquainted first hand with the decay of the Russian gentry. Just in this one case. No real wife, no children. They lived with some serfs, I mean, some servants. They had no money for the borrowers, the Jews. And then there was, for example, there was a Jew lived next door who was some kind of merchant who had nothing to do with Andreapolis, who had a tremendous horse-drawn carriage with four horses, terrific chap in and out, tremendous gambler in some kind of casino in some local town. He used to take my mother for rides. The officers used to come and see my mother in the evening. He used to read aloud the Russian novels to her, first to her, mildly. All that was quite well. Nobody minded. And that was a kind of Chekhov life, rather.
Yeah.
A little bit three sisters. But what I learned from it, as I was going to do, was that there was no difference in Kodesh Rochol. If you ask what our life was, the Jewish religion was part of our lives intrinsically. It didn't matter who was pious or not. Some people were genuinely pious, and some people probably were not. But the Jewish religion and the quotation of the Bible, the biblical, so to speak, tags, I mean, as it were, formally borrowed naturally from the Bible, and the kind of Hebrew which comes from Yiddish, and references to the Talmud, which writes from also exactly the point.
Oh, yes.
You see, that was universal. And I then understood what the Middle Ages were like, for the Goyim, not just the Jews. When you had a religious establishment, it didn't matter who believed or not. There wasn't a thing called something secular, something religious. It was one. And I suddenly saw that the language they used was soaked in the Bible, in the Talmud, in the Tariach Mitzvot, in what they did, in how they behaved, in the Kashrut and all the business which accompanies it. It was a full Jewish life. It was natural life for them. Absolutely unartificial.
Now, when you describe this...
This I realized later.
Oh, you? I mean...
At the time, obviously not.
Oh, and again to the decaying gentry. Probably you also, later sure. When you read Turgenev, it was the illustration.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Yes. Of course. But when I now remember, I know what I remember. But above all, this kind of life which was so, this kind of fact, there was no frontier between religion and ordinary life. Fantastic. Is something which I saw there. And never in Riga. And never in Petersburg. You see? It's never. The ghetto in Riga was also like that. But we didn't live in the ghetto. We lived in a handsome apartment on a smart Riga street, which is called the Albertstrasse. Albertovska. You see, there was a relationship there, but I never saw it. They gave it the kitchen call. You see?
Now, your mother, she didn't complain that she wanted to go back to Riga?
Never. Never. Didn't particularly like it. Particularly attached to it. Nor was my father. My father was an Anglomaniac from a very early phase. He traveled Europe for the business. He was the, so to speak, European. He was evaluating. they liked the Lebanese to French. He went to Germany, he went to Holland, he went to France, he went to England. He talked these languages, not Dutch, but the others. And he had English friends, my businessmen, acquaintances. He stayed in Barclays sometimes. He stayed in London. He stayed in Paris. He knew Western Europe quite normally. And that was partly part of the melting of religion too. And I thought that we were all right. So there we were in Petrograd. The first thing, we went from Andreapolis, the main office in Petrograd about 1916, I think. Samura was in another similar village in the employment of my father. He was not a successful lawyer.
Yeah.
All right. Then comes Petrograd, Vansky, followed by Ravreve. Among the pupils of Ravreve, I can tell you who came with me. There were three families with which I was associated. A family called Draini, some who settled in Israel. And one interesting case, I would like to tell you. There were two rabbis in Petrograd. One, we know the Russian system. One was a real rabbi, and the other was a official rabbi.
Rav Mitam.
Rav what?
Mitam. That's the Hebrew term. Nominated by the authorities. That's the Hebrew name.
Mitam.
Rav Mitam. Mitam. Mitam HaShiltonot.
Mitam.
The official rabbi.
The real rabbi was Volkert Snellenbogen. He was a saintly Talmudist of considerable order. The other man was called Eisenstadt. Perfectly nice, thoroughly decent Jewish rabbi. He was not at all a Jewish rabbi. He wasn't, he spoke Russian, he spoke German. The other spoke only Yiddish, of course. I mean, no contact with going at all. Eisenstadt was a man who naturally wrote birth, death, I mean, did all the official parts. He went to Paris afterwards and moved among the rich, white, sort of Russian Jews. Quite a nice man. Now, Eisenstadt, Katzenellenbogen, had a son. The son was my fellow pupil. And he was called... I wish I could remember. First name. His nephew was Moses Finley.
The classic historian. Finkelstein.
This man's daughter. This man, he was his uncle. His aunt, his sister. Must have married Finkelstein.
It's the Katzenelbogen or the Eisenstadt?
Katzenelbogen. Because when I got to know Finley, by the way, I'm simply storytelling. One day, when I knew Finley, I suddenly discovered that he was somehow, I don't know, it came up, that he was a nephew of my schoolfellow who went to Israel and learned that. He certainly did. And Rav Rebbe was always telling me how much better he was.
About?
How much better.
Uh-huh.
Just as my teacher in Riga, after the revolution, with that for about 4 months, used to tell me how much better Leibovitch was than I was.
Than you.
Museum. Now, what was the name of the name? I always meant to look him up. He's probably dead by now, I think. He may not be. Katzenellenbogen is the name.
Yes.
Quite a normal Jewish name.
Yes, there were several Katzenellenbogens in Israel.
He was called... the Russian name. Like...
I mean, the first name.
First name. I mean, a Jewish Russian name.
Yes.
Like Yaakov
Boris
or Isaac or... Boris is not Jewish.
No. You mean the Jewish name?
Biblical
name.
Abraham or Yitzchak.
Yes.
Isaac, or
yeah.
Avram, or
Moshe,
or Moise,
yeah.
Or one of these yeah. Russified former,
yeah.
Yes.
There was an eminent dermatologist by the name Katzenelbogen in the 30s and 40s.
Mm-hmm. What was his first name?
I can find out. And there are others.
Anyhow, I'm Finley with his nephew.
I see.
And... that was my And then there were other people, boys, who were also my fellow pupils. That's where I met Leonard Shapiro.
You met him in Petrograd?
Of course. His parents were Stoshchev, all from Riga.
Yes.
His parents, his grandfather was called, what was his name? Philip Shapiro. Jews in the ghetto were not called Philip.
Yeah.
And his grandmother I knew Philip Shapiro's wife. After he lived in Germany. Perfectly nice woman. His son, Leonard's father, was called Max. And Max's brother was called James. All of which was already superior.
Oh la la.
Max was sent to Glasgow to learn some kind of trade and married the local cousin's daughter.
And Leonard is their son.
Leonard is their son. She was called Lea Shapiro. Her brother, one of her brothers, was the Reverend Ephraim Levine of New West End Synagogue. Another brother, professor of philosophy, called Levine from the University of Exeter. Third brother went to South Africa with sisters. And the fourth brother was, changed his name, no, he's called Levine, changed him to Alpha. Levine was the chief actuary of some Rothschild insurance company. That was the Levine family from Glasgow. But she was the English, she spoke English very bad Russian. Leonard's her son. Max Shapiro came from Riga. His uncle, Max's uncle, and his great uncle, Shukman, has just written his life, Dictionary of National Biography, over some document. He sent it to me. He says his uncle is wrong. I told him that. His great uncle was a member of the Duma.
The great the uncle Russian. Of Leonard.
Great uncle.
Was a member of the Duma.
Yakov Shapiro.
Yes.
And him I knew in London afterwards. He came to London in 1912 when he left the Duma. He became an Anglomaniac and gave an authority on the 17th century in England. And he sold all his books to Max Dollard. And he was killed during the war by a bomb, destroyed him, his books, his dog. Everything was about it.
The second one?
Yes. And Yakov Shapiro, the name was. A strange, interesting man, who I still knew. The Duma member. He never became British subject because he did not be a second-class citizen. Did not be naturalized. Now, I'm telling you one of the stories. I knew the Leonard there. Leonard was about 2 years older. He was gifted. He introduced me to the paintings of Benoit, Bax, all the Diaghilev painters of that time. One was sophisticated in life, everyone was. He was made little sculptures of the dying Marat, French Revolution.
Who, Elema?
Leonard, yes. Not genuinely. He was not much of a Jew, but they went to synagogue, of course. We meet in synagogue, that is inevitable. The chief in the head synagogue of Petrograd, which was built by Aline's grandfather. And we used to take holidays in the same suburbs of Petrograd together, Pavlov's place, like that, and so on. And there, he and I used to wander, you know, girls together. Parties and so on. He was a friend of my youth, but much more sophisticated, much more, you know, altogether superior. And he used to lend me novels by Alexandre Dumas, things like that.
That was in 19...
But he spoke English already, then, because his mother taught him English.
He spoke?
Never. Talked Russian to me.
Where was it? In Petrograd?
Yes. 1916, 1917, 1918. In 19 we all left Russia more the same time. We all went to Riga.
So his father married a...
In Glasgow.
In Glasgow and brought his wife to...
And Leonard was born in Glasgow.
I see.
His wife is a British citizen by birth. Mm-hmm. You see? But then he was taken back to Riga, where he grew up. And but even there was this kid. They used to go to the house, they used to act little Chekhov plays at Christmas, or they did Cricket on the Hearth, and Dickens is a play. It was all much more European. But still, I also went to the opera in Petersburg, of course. I went to Constance's home, which I saw very good in Novo Shalapin, in Marie's Cathedral. So, on that one side, the other side is Reber and Bansky, could not do Lenin, but no Jewish education of any kind at all, not any.
Now, you would go with your friends or with your parents to the opera?
With my parents, as you made that. No, with my, yes, with, I guess, one of my distant cousins became a governess to me. I think I probably went with her. And I read all the novels, the French drama, the Jules Verne, in Russian, about 40 volumes there. And then came the revolution. I was not set to school. Bolshevik. During the revolution, schools were no good. Bolshevik schools were impossible. So then, that's why I got Vansky and only Rabreva and only Titus. That was all during the revolution. The last one was called Kitai. I didn't like Rabreva, I asked for somebody else. I was given all the Hebrew lessons. My children were given it in London, in the Titus. And then we repatriated to Riga as Latin citizens. Ur Latin, to born in Riga, quite legally. They didn't quite want to believe, even though it was difficult to prove, that my mother spoke Latin, because one of my nurses, Latin, anybody spoke Latin in Baltimore, nobody else spoke Latin, except people with that, not the language.
Of course.
People knew that these people were peasants and nobody spoke to the Lets. Completely downtrodden population, with Baltic barons, completely crushed. But not the report. When we left Russia, we traveled in a train very slowly from Petrograd to Riga.
There were no problems? You were running away or you were just going?
Legally.
No running.
We were allowed to go back if we wanted. And anybody from Riga could so to speak, determine, self-determination, determined to be a Latvian citizen, in which case we let out. This was something against me. My father's brother remained in Riga, but my father and mother and I left. So did Shapiro in the same way. So did my mother's parents, and so did my father's father. That generation came back to Riga. So did my aunt and uncle. Some one of them was all, they were Vindal, not Riga, but with all Latvian origins. Now, we went first of all to the frontier, then there was a train took about 10 days, but 2 miles an hour, and the searches. Then we came to quarantine, Latvian quarantine, diseases, Soviet. Then we got a night train to Riga. My mother unfortunately understood Latvian. She was sitting opposite two men who made extremely anti-Semitic remarks to each other. That my mother was not prepared to bear. So in Latvian, she said to them, there may be a great deal which is wrong with the Soviet Union, but that does not exist. It is not quite true, but in 1919,
one believed,
you could say, Jews were in power, with no official anti-Semitism, and you did not come across it.
Yeah.
Secretly,
it
was completely hostile, completely out. Whatever Lenin was, he was not there. These men were extremely taken aback. And she went on telling them, more or less denounced, lost it. At the next station, they got out, and they made a telephone call to Riga, saying that they met a Soviet agent. Another Soviet agent, the comical idea of the story. When we arrived in Riga, the next station, two policemen entered and arrested us. My father was beside himself. We were arriving, no money. Riga, poor. Refugees almost. I mean, we didn't know if we had any money in Riga or not. But some, we had some money in Russia. It was taken out. I mean, we were destitute. But still, it was agreeable to arrive under guard. When we arrived in Riga station, a man approached my father and said he was a Latvian detective. He was in the train, he was in the carriage. For a sum of money, he was prepared to swear my mother didn't say it. Completely innocent. The money was handed over, and my mother was allowed to go. Because the detective immediately testified at the police headquarters that this is all false. The men went on prosecuting. All the time in Riga, they brought a case against him as a Soviet agent. Finally, the sort of juge d'instruction, that's how it was on the judge who had investigated, yeah. French system, said, look, are you staying in this country? No. Are you going to some other country? Yes. Where are you going to England? Or let go, the case will be quashed. Otherwise, it's gone forever.
Yeah.
That I'm really telling you the story to show what my mother was like.
Yeah.
And the 70s was not to be tolerated.
Now, did you remember it, or did they tell you?
No, I saw it.
You saw it?
I was there. I saw my mother on the guard. I wasn't told it. I saw the policeman. I saw my father dreadfully upset. I saw my relation with him to meet us upset. Yes. Well, they were terrible. Arrival with an arrested mother. Nobody understood what could have happened.
Yeah. Yes.
Denounced by two anti-Semitic lads.
Yeah. Yeah.
She was talked about.
Yeah, I saw your mother and I'm not surprised. I'll come back to
it. My mother was exceedingly very solid.
I could see. I'm going to tell you.
She felt what she felt. There was no compromise.
Yeah.
And she was a Jewish man. And when Zionism came, she was 1,000% Zionist. From the beginning, with no doubts, no hesitations, nothing was wrong at all. She wasn't even critical or given attitudes and so on, but she sort of joined Zionist society. She became head of a little Zionist women's society in Hempstead, with Lord Goodman's mother, who was a member.
Yeah. Well, I had 20 questions. I asked only one.
Good.
All right, but that's good. And I was coming to your mother because I was impressed by her and I wanted to ask you some questions.
My mother was Eshet Chayim.
She was Eshet Chayim.
Strong personality.
Yeah, that's what I got the impression. I remember one lunch at your place. She was there and Aline's mother was there. And your mother dominated the scene.
No doubt.
I should never forget it.
Where was this?
In Headington.
Headington, yes.
It was probably 62 or 61.
No, no. My mother was had an extremely, so to speak, powerful temperament.
And very energetic.
Yes.
Small and energetic.
Life. Vitality.
And one could one could sense it. And
she had no wish to go to England.
No wish?
No wish to go to England.
I see.
She'd never been there. She spoke German. In Germany, you could buy a house for 2 and 6 months. Inflation in 1919 was already beginning, 1920 was. It was obvious that she always hankered to go, to buy a house quite cheaply. She deeply respected Germany and the Germans, because that was Riga education, you see? So why not even Berlin? My father spoke perfect German. Why England? My father was an absolute rabid Angloman who refused to go anywhere. He was determined and was going to school in England, wherever they lived. He had an English partner when he did business in England. The partner had opened him on a very close term, called George Payne. George Payne told him that the English did not live in towns. The English lived in the country. So my father was not to live in London. London is full of Jews, Russians, and other undesirables. My father was fundamentally an assimilated Jew.
That's what I was going to ask.
I mean, all right, you went to synagogue.
Yes, I mean, but but mentality.
Mentality was, he did not crave the living among Jews. I mean, he was quite, he didn't spurn them. But basically, it was like Ali's father. Basically, what he liked was ordinary Gentile life. He liked French comedies on the stage. He liked reading French and English novels. I mean, the whole Jewish part had clearly come off. He was a very easygoing man, very amiable, who had never done very much in his life. He never made or lost money. He was never rich, never poor. Timid, tactful, very gentle. He never gambled. And he's all these sort of Russian Jews, the Shalits people, tremendous gamblers, Belovs, all these people, despised him as a rather
timid.
Nothing, he didn't play bridge, he didn't drink. I mean, the life of Russian, the Russian Jews in Hampstead were bohemian, fundamentally. My family didn't see them, I met them very, very occasionally. They never invited anyone, and they never went out. They had a very, very quiet life in Kensington, not in Hampstead. He didn't want to mix with these people too much. He knew them, quite liked them. The English would be liked. And so we didn't live in London, we lived in Surbiton, which was a third suburb of London. It was not at all the country. It was where Mr. Payne lived. He called it the country. It was a comical suburb of London, where there were no Jews. We arrived, I remember, by Berlin, Calais, Dover. My father met us in Dover, he was already in England. By the time we left, we traveled by a special compartment to London, from London to Surbiton, and then we stayed in some typical English bungalow, or a sort of Anglo Indian type, built by some Anglo Indian. In the morning, I'd eggs and bacon. I'm telling you, an English maid, I spoke no English. And I learned, I did have an English teacher in Petrograd, I spoke 50 words, 200 words. But then I got an English teacher, Russian woman who was an English born person. I went to school, private school itself. The story about my mother, which I'm telling you so much, but my son, my mind, this is all I got to do at school with the English boys and girls. I spoke broken English, I'm sure. They were infant kind of. I was not bullied. I was not laughed at. Very insulted. It was a low middle class. The level. One boy once said to me, "Aren't you a dirty German?" From Berlin. The other boys beat him up. Unique. Unbelievable. Yeah. That's what, fundamentally, I was grew up in anti-Semitic atmosphere. Yeah. Rather unusual. You see, this is rather innocent at school.
Yes.
They were outside the my main currents of English life. They were children of shopkeepers, doctors, local solicitors, you can imagine, and so on, you see, retired officers. It was a very deep Victorian life, still.
How long did you live there?
A year. Already at the end of the year, I took part in the school play, Babes in the Wood, it was called, and I was already so on it. I already got the second prize in English, I'm sorry to say, for some little English essay, a little description of an imaginary scene from the Russian Revolution. Now, my mother, therefore, I trade for it, says my father. Eggs and bacon, fine.
She didn't mind.
It appeared not. We began complete English life. No Jews in Serbia, a few relations and friends in London occasionally. But broadly, we had an absolutely isolated life. I played cricket, I played football, it was all perfectly normal. One day, my mother went to the butcher, Mr. Earnshaw, by some meat, and she saw an old gentleman in the corner with a little beard. He looked a lot Christian, same shit as we said. He said, that's the Reverend Mr. Vogelnest. From Birdnest. Vogelnest. From Reading. And he's here because he does the meet for the two Jewish families who live there. We didn't know they existed. My mother naturally went up to him. He talked to her. She burst into tears. After that, kosher. Forever after. My father didn't care whether he ate it or not. He put up with it. Outside the house, we were allowed to eat everything. My mother not. The kashrut was not a very superior kind. It only meant kosher meat.
Yes.
But that didn't do. It's not especially kept, but still.
Yeah.
The point was, no trefa was allowed.
No trefa.
No. And there was some things, so to speak, uneasiness about it. But that we refused to accept. But that was all right. No shellfish appeared. But anyhow, we didn't know. So, I'm just trying to think what else happened. And by this time, of course, we all went to synagogue on the high holidays, occasional Shabbat, lived in ordinary bourgeois English life in London.
Now,
but then, in Surbiton, we discovered that there was a minyan at Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur of some sort of neighboring Jews who came together. And there we found Mr. Scott, a gabbai whose name was Schulze, who spoke good English. He had to change his name during the war because it was terrible anti-German persecution in the First World War. Schulze. Was called somebody called Englander. Englander is also a German name. Two Jewish families, and then they produced a few others. With difficulty, the minyan was created. But we only went once, because by that time we were already en route to London. My mother broke her ankle, and in order to mend it, she had to go to nursing home in London. After that, we all moved.
Now, did they argue, your mother and your father, about the attitude toward Jews and Gentiles? I mean...
In Serbian, I was a goy. Serbian was my most goyish period. When I was at school, it never came up. So I was a Russian. The headmaster was extremely nice to me. When my mother broke her ankle and had to move to London, I practically lived in school. I had my meals there. My father was in the city. He used to come home in the evenings. I trained, and I had breakfast with him, lunch and tea and dinner with the headmaster and his wife, who was extremely nice.
In Surbiton?
In Surbiton. They treated me as a little Russian boy. The fact I was a Jew never emerged. I didn't mention it, they didn't mention it. There was no occasion, you see, and they never asked the word Jew. You see what I mean? Anyhow, they had, I suppose they would have reacted in some way. But anyhow, as far as I knew, I lived, and all my friends were little English boys. So, there's one Jew among them I didn't like. So, I think he's called Fatty Englander. And then, none of us quite different business. Leonard Shapiro came to see us, and Max, and Leo's wife, they visited. But fundamentally, I had a totally English life for something like a year. June, February, or March of 1920. No, we came to England 1921. From February, early February 20, till March or April 21, I was with Judenrein. I had no contact in Serbia.
Did you get the Times every day?
No. Certainly not. My father read the Telegraph. My father was conservative. But he liked Lloyd George, the great admirer of Churchill. He used to talk to her politics, which bored me beyond words. I could not this. He took a very intelligent, lifelong interest in English politics. When he came to Oxford during the war, last war, when I was already done, New College, he used to talk about politics with David Sisson, my friend. They got on extremely well. So, I think there you go.
And you didn't read newspapers at that period. You were not...
I'm the least interested. I may have looked through.
Yes, pictures. But...
All I remember is, I remember the Australian cricket team came. That was very important.
Yes.
I remember that the government...